Hello everyone. So I'm here to talk today about reviving the single gender scenario for the supernova that formed in 0509. This may be a little bit contentious, but please hear me out. So just a whirlwind review. One is have a spectrum with hydrogen, strong silicon, light curves help with subtype groups. We heard about all this already. And we also heard, the biggest mystery really with these 1As, while we agree it's a carbon-oxygen white dwarf that's exploding, the progenitor system is pretty unclear and obviously unsettled, as we've seen. So the few pictures up top, the single degenerate, where you have a white dwarf feeding off of a main sequence or post-main sequence companion, or in the other scenario on the bottom, the double degenerate scenario, where you have two white dwarfs that coalesce and explode. So, 0509 is a very special object to consider for several reasons. And the first is, we know for sure this was a 1A remnant, besides the fact that it's polymer dominated and the X-ray spectrum shows a lack of oxygen group elements. We actually have direct spectroscopic confirmation from the light echoes from REFS et al. 2008, which we see here on the right. And in particular, it was typed even further to be a 1991 T-like overluminous supernova. So, another thing that sets remnant apart from others is it belongs to a subclass of Balmer dominated remnants. Now, the nice thing about this is where we see the Balmer emission, we know we're looking at the forward shock that's interacting with a partially neutral interstellar medium. So, for an example, up here I have 0519, which we obtained salt spectrum from the South African Large Telescope. And we see just Balmer emission lines. Here's a zoom in of the broad component of the H alpha line. So the two components that we see is first a narrow component that arises from collisional excitations as neutral hydrogen enters the shock, and a broad component which arises from charge exchange of neutral hydrogen entering the shock with a post-shock ion. Now, since we know these Balmer dominated remnants that we're looking definitively at the forward shock, we can actually put a physical velocity on these shock speeds if we measure the proper motions, because these remnants live in the best place possible, the Large Magellanic Cloud. And that's important because we know the distance to these remnants with much greater accuracy than any of the galactic remnants. So in my paper in 2015, with Jack Hughes and Chris Erickson, we measured the proper motions of the forward shock with two EPICs obtained with HSD, ACS, and unfortunately with MIG 2 after the ACS died. And here a difference image. So from this, we placed rectangular apertures all around the outer rim of the remnant, from which we made one-dimensional spatial brightness profiles. So here the dotted line is the first EPIC profile, the solid black line is the second EPIC profile, and the red line that's overlaid is the best fit solution of the first EPIC shifted to the second EPIC, with the residuals seen here in purple. So with this technique, we were able to measure the forward shock speed, the global shock speed, to be 6,500 kilometers per second. Now, there was a result by Bradley Schaefer and Ashley Pangiota that claims this has to be a double degenerate progenitor system because they find no stars within their search radius for a progenitor. But we decided to take advantage of these pretty precise measurements to actually look at, do we see an east-west asymmetry in the expansion velocity, which may offset the explosion site in the geometric center that we see today. So to accomplish this, we took a selection of our extraction apertures, where we had symmetric coverage on roughly the east and west sides. Unfortunately, our second epoch with big data, we weren't able to obtain measurements of the shock expansion in the northwest or in the southern portion of the ring because the signal noise was just too low with big data. So this lies almost on the semi-minor axis if you were to fit an ellipse. So for the rest of the talk, when I refer to this side, I'm just going to be calling it the east side, even though it's not perfectly east and west, respectively. And what we see here in the center is our measured geometric center, which we obtained by taking all of our regions and fitting an ellipse. And we show the 3 sigma contour, which is on the order of 0.6 arcseconds. So to make this measurement, we took all of these expansions and projected the velocities onto our dynamical axis to determine the east-west asymmetry and expansion. And we also found the radii from with respect to our geometric center. So we get a shot speed of 6730 in the east and 5740 in the west. Now, the individual radii aren't so important because, like I said, we're not sure if that's actually the center. So the diameter is the more important thing when we move on to our next step, which is actually using hydrodynamic simulations to try to determine what our surge radius should be. Now, with hydrodynamic simulations, you really have 3 main parameters to play with. You have the surrounding density of the material with which the forward shock will interact. You have the energy of the explosion as it initially goes off. And you also have the mass of the star, the mass of the ejecta that will be expanding outward. So, first, what we did is we worked with the assumption, let's say that the east and west sides were expanding into different density materials through the lifetime of its evolution. And we took 3 different energies for this, which corresponds to our work in HOBE 2015 of 1.0, 1.2, and 1.4 times 10 to the 51 Hertz. Our best case is really this 1.4 times 10 to the 51 Hertz, which Carlos reported on based on the light echo spectrum from REST 2008. And they all pretty much agree you get about 8/10 of an arcsecond dynamical shift to the west from the geometric center along that dynamical axis. Now, the second assumption we made is let's see what would happen if instead of varying the density, we varied the initial explosion energy, so an asymmetric explosion on the eastern and western sides. And we took 3 different densities for this, and these correspond to our best fit densities from our hydrodynamic simulations for, again, equals 5 Hertz gas. And the thing that's, you know, we were able to get solutions, but this may be a little bit unrealistic, this east-west energy distribution to be a factor of 2. So we really treat this to be our limiting case for how far the dynamical offset really could be to the east, which is about 1.4 arcseconds. Now, the third case I mentioned is you could play with the ejecta mass. Well, we found through much trial that you can't really recover the asymmetry we see in the shock speeds with only varying the ejecta mass. So we just discarded this for this purpose. When you could get a fit, you get really unrealistic masses on the order of 1/10 of a solar mass on one side and you know, 1/20 of a solar mass on the other side. So clearly that's not realistic. So the third case we decided to explore was more of a thought experiment. Well, what if the interaction, instead of it being a lifetime asymmetry in the density, was rather a recent interaction? And in that case, you can imagine a case where Just in the past few years, it's hit this overdensity, which has retarded the velocity on the western side, in which case the actual geometric center would be a very good approximation for the explosion site. So we also have evidence of this asymmetry based on our work in the southwest when we were comparing our results to Evelyn Helder's for checking for efficient cosmic ray acceleration. We found that this outer fainter filament was moving along at 8,500 kilometers per second, but this dense interior filament, which is only about an arc second away, or less than an arc second away, has a velocity of 3,800 kilometers per second. So by the sheer nature of this having such a higher velocity than this filament, which is spatially very close, it's likely that this is a recent density enhancement that the Southwest is interacting with. So, here we show our three centers. Again, for comparison, that green circle that we saw before, this is the same size for the zoom-in. So here's our geometric center. The blue cross marks the case where we have a lifetime density asymmetry. So here's the dynamical offset. The solid blue contour marks out the three sigma uncertainty. And then we have a dashed blue circle, which is kind of hard to see, which we then boost our three sigma uncertainty by the largest possible kick velocity of about 450 kilometers per second, along with our maximum possible age that we determined of about 400 years. So the purple cross marks the case of the energy asymmetry. And again, the same convention, three sigma uncertainty plus a kick velocity. Now, for the case where it's a recent density asymmetry, we didn't go through the process of running those calculations. We just took the uncertainties from the case of the lifetime density asymmetry to be conservative, though these would likely be smaller in size with a more rigorous approach. But as you can see, we have 21 possible progenitor candidates here. So this alone should be enough to convince you that the single degenerate scenario is not dead for 0509. So, well, you might ask, well, what about the stars? Is there anything special about any of these? And we, you know, we obtained photometry in five different bands, 475, 555, 814. We got some archival data for the taken with WIFC3, and then two IR bands taken with WIFC3IR. So we're currently in the process of fitting more sophisticated isochrones using five bands, but for our primary look here, we could look at the HR diagram between the 814 and the 555 filters. And here we show three different evolutionary tracks for 1 giga years, 6 giga years, and 15 giga years. And the asterisks are kind of hard to see. They're a little easier to see here because they have larger uncertainties, or our magnitudes for the 814 minus 555. And you can see that we don't see any giant stars here, or supergiant stars. So this really pulls out the single degenerate models of recurrent novae and symbiotic stars. But we do, however, find a few stars between one solar mass and 1.5 solar mass. So we can eliminate the possibility that this was a super soft source. Now, the rest of these stars are below one solar mass, and we have one sitting fairly close to the 0.5 solar masses. So besides the typical picture, there's two other pictures to consider. One is called the spin-up, spin-down scenario, which is explored by DiStefano. And in this case, you have two main sequence stars. One becomes a white dwarf, and it starts cannibalizing off the other star. But if the white dwarf has a very high spin, even if it accretes enough mass to approach the Chandrasekhar mass, the density isn't sufficient for it to pop off. So what can actually happen is while it's slowly spinning down, the other star could have completely evolved off the main sequence and become a white dwarf itself, in which case we're below our threshold of detection in these bands. And in another scenario by Wheeler 2012, you can have a case where you have an M dwarf and a white dwarf binary system. Now, the special thing about M dwarfs is they're highly magnetized stars. So what can happen is you have the M dwarf becomes magnetically locked with the white dwarf star, and this creates a so-called magnetic bottle through which material can accrete efficiently enough onto the white dwarf for it to grow its mass. And in this case, you actually have a range of conditions for the M dwarf. It could be completely destroyed based on how much of it is cannibalized, or it could be left mainly intact. Either way, we're really looking at a case again where we're really below our threshold of detection to find a progenitor companion. So as the old adage goes, an absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Just because you don't find a companion star in one of these remnants, you cannot discount the possibility that it's a single degenerate explosion. So, our main conclusions is using our hydrodynamic simulations under these three cases of a lifetime density asymmetry, an energy asymmetry, or a recent density enhancement, we constrain our area to look for our progenitor companions. Without knowing the actual evolutionary history of 0509, it's impossible to say one of these is the one we should look at. We really need to look at all three to be as agnostic as possible. And fitting isochrones to our photometry, we find the range of these 21 stars to be between a half a solar mass and 1.5 solar masses. And just to start going home again, we cannot rule out the single degenerate progenitor system that gave rise to the supernova remnant 0509. Thank you.
So the density profile that you were expanding these blastoids into was just a step function, is that correct?
No. So they were just one side had one density, the other side had another density to begin with, and it just expanded.
Right. So there was just a...
Right. But each side had its own unique simulations. They were just constrained to have the same age.
So you actually did 1D?
Yes.
Okay.
So we did, sorry.
Very nice work. So I think you mentioned, this might be just a minor comment, that there is no red giant star and thus it cannot have been a normal part of Yuki light system. That's not quite true because when the shockwave hits the giant star, it would strip the giant star. It would strip the material and the giant star will not
light. Right, that's an excellent point. So this is a really naive statement I made. But that's really due to us being really unclear about the exact conditions of the surviving companion with the shockwave around it.
Yeah, this was just from otherwise, like, oh, yes, I agree, like, no, all these things might be potential companions. Going back to your sense of determination, and maybe you've got this hydro simulation, how long do these hydro simulations take, roughly? How long do they take on your computer? I'm wondering if you just can stand the parameter space and essentially, like, you know, do a proper posterior for, like, the center.
Well, the thing that's nice about these hydrodynamic simulations is the solutions for the expansion are self-similar. So you really only need to run one simulation at all. And then you have put it in dimensionless units, and then you can recast it into dimensional units based on your choice of ejecta mass, the external density, and the energy of the explosion. So you're not really running the hydro every time. You're really just solving a system of equations each time, then looking, you know, where is the forward shock and how fast is it going and how does that compare to our measured constraints and diameter and those two velocities.
Thank you.
Okay, well, it's the end of the day. I think we're all tired. I want to thank Luke and thank all the speakers today.